I think it's unrealistic to think that I would be successful in a write-in effort.
Gubernatorial candidate Bill Walker decides against re-entering the race. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 27th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, applying lessons from the BP oil spill to Alaska's Arctic.
The reality of the Arctic is that you don't have United States Coast Guard response capacity in the same way that we had in the Gulf of Mexico.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
A hearing for the first of five soldiers accused of deliberately killing Afghan civilians this year has begun with more than a dozen witnesses asserting their right to remain silent, including the lieutenant who headed their platoon. Corporal Jeremy Morlock of Wasilla faces charges including premeditated murder in the deaths of the three civilians. Army prosecutors are relying heavily on statements Morlock made in which he described the plot as an effort to murder the civilians for sport. The hearing will determine whether Morlock's case proceeds to a court-martial. The prosecution of the five soldiers for allegedly murdering Afghan civilians appears to hinge on videotaped testimony rather than hard evidence. Army investigators acknowledged today they never recovered the bodies of the three Afghan men the soldiers are accused of murdering earlier this year. This fact came out during the hearing in the case to determine if Morlock should face court-martial for murder. His attorney, Michael Waddington, hopes to show the investigation into the killings was shoddy.
We haven't seen any evidence that shows that they did a proper crime scene investigation. They made no efforts to look for the bodies to determine what actually killed this person. Was it a grenade? Was it gunshots? Was it a machine gun? What was it?
In fact, investigators never visited two of the murder scenes in Afghanistan because it was too dangerous. Morlock described the killings in a videotaped statement to Army doctors, but his attorneys say he was doped up on a medley of prescription drugs at the time he described his role in the killings. Army prosecutors say they have multiple corroborating stories from soldiers about what happened and photographic evidence of the crimes. Army Special Agent Anderson Wagner testified today that Morlock's videotaped statement describing how he and his colleagues randomly killed the three Afghan civilians appears to be a reliable account. Agent Wagner testified that Morlock was articulate during the interviews. The hearing at Joint Base Lewis-McChord will determine whether the case proceeds to a court-martial. Morlock and the others could face the death penalty if convicted. The dismissal earlier this month of a subsistence violation against Senator Albert Kukesh could prompt major changes in the state's subsistence fishing policy if the ruling stands up to an expected appeal. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
When Albert Kukesh, an Angoon Democrat, and three friends were cited in July of 2009 for overfishing their subsistence permits in Kanalshku Bay near Angoon, the senator appeared ready to make a Katie John-style constitutional argument questioning the state's authority to manage subsistence on federal lands. Angoon is situated on Admiralty Island, a national monument. Kukesh told KCAW in 2009 that he thought he'd end up paying the state's $500 fine, but he also thought the case was headed for federal court. Dual management, or the state's enforcement of federal subsistence authority, has been the de facto system of subsistence management since the legislature in the 1980s and 90s failed to pass an amendment to the state constitution and reconcile state and federal law. Kukesh thought he was in the right for several reasons, most importantly that the state had crossed the line when it sent a trooper onto federal lands to cite him for overfishing sockeye salmon in a beach seine.
Process argument about if you wanted to manage fish and game on federal lands, then you should have adopted a constitutional amendment when we had the opportunity.
But Sitka Superior Court Judge David George, acting as magistrate in Angoon District Court, touched on none of that when he dismissed charges against Kukesh and two of the men involved. A third, Scott Hunter, still faces a violation for fishing without a permit. Instead, George's 16-page dismissal focuses exclusively on state law, especially the Administrative Procedures Act, which he wrote, quote, requires that notice of the proposed adoption of a regulation be published and disseminated 30 days before adoption, close quote. The state gave no such notice in 2006 when it reduced the catch limit for Kanalshku subsistence sockeye from 25 to 15 fish. Hence, Judge George ruled that the limit could not form the basis for prosecution in this case.
We think that we followed the correct procedure in the delegation that the Board of Fisheries gave us to set those types of limits.
That's Denby Lloyd, the outgoing commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. In most, if not all, subsistence fisheries in southeast Alaska, participants don't learn the catch limit for a particular area until they pick up their permits. In Sitka, for instance, the catch limit for sockeye at Redoubt Lake is set every year with no public participation, nor are there hearings for Salmon Lake or Clag Bay. Lloyd says the district court's interpretation of the Kukesh case could create a procedural snarl for the state that the Board of Fisheries process can't handle.
There are a number of subsistence fisheries, particularly throughout Southeast, that are managed with these types of harvest limits set under permit conditions, and that allows the department to tailor those limits to biological conditions in any particular year. So if in the end it's decided that we can't operate that way, then we will have to have much, much more engaged discussions with the Board of Fisheries, and I'm not sure that the system can effectively handle that kind of load.
Prosecutor Doug Gardner says the state respects George's ruling, but his motion for reconsideration makes clear that he believes the judge overlooked a couple of important points of law, especially the statutory authority of the Board of Fisheries to set catch limits. What George interpreted as setting subsistence bag limits in a back room, Gardner and the state see as a delegation of the board's authority to manage, protect, maintain, improve, and extend the fish resources of the state. Clearly, there are some big questions surrounding this case, which, after all, is not a crime. Kukesh's violation is basically a ticket from the state police. Gardner says the motion for dismissal is a routine way to clarify a case for a judge and is not necessarily a prelude to an appeal.
There are a number of different regulations and statutes that we believe we want to make sure that the courts had an opportunity to review in the context of making the decision. So we'll await the outcome of whether or not the court decides to reconsider or not. I don't think there's more than meets the eye. We're just trying to make sure that our record is made and that the court has a full and fair opportunity to consider any last-minute things that might have an impact on the court's decision.
Commissioner Lloyd, however, says ADF&G, which has filed an amicus brief, will move the case to appellate court if necessary.
But we're recommending at this time that it be appealed, and Department of Law is going through that review.
Judge George has 30 days to rule on the motion for reconsideration. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Bill Walker says he will not continue his gubernatorial bid. He says finishing second in the Republican primary last month with about a third of the vote led him to consider pursuing his chances through a write-in campaign, but he doesn't think it's likely he could win in a three-candidate race.
I think we had an incredible message. I think Alaskans believe in that message, and so I'm going to stay focused on the message and not on the campaign. I think it's unrealistic to think that I would be successful in a write-in effort. And so as a result of that, I have no interest in influencing necessarily the outcome of the race.
Walker's major opponents, Republican Sean Parnell and Democrat Ethan Berkowitz, have both made attempts to get the support of the 35,000 people who voted for Walker in the primary election. Berkowitz says he has met with Walker and offered him a role in his administration to lead his efforts to develop the All Alaska Gas Project. He also says Walker raised other important issues that need to be considered.
The gas line is a critical piece of the state's economy into the future, and it's a critical piece of what we're going to do for jobs in the near term in front of us. And so we both have expressed concern about the course that Sean Parnell has put us on. He's someone who's done nothing in the face of real challenges that the state faces. We've got to do a lot more if we're going to survive intact and if we're going to prosper into the future.
Parnell issued a press release asking Walker's supporters to, quote, stand together against the Obama team in Alaska, Ethan Berkowitz and Diane Benson. Walker says he is not likely to endorse either candidate. One of the lead lawyers who prosecuted Senator Ted Stevens has killed himself, according to NPR. Nicholas Marsh committed suicide over the weekend. He was one of the main prosecutors of Ted Stevens 2 years ago. While Stevens was convicted of lying on financial disclosure forms, the case was ultimately thrown out because the prosecutors were accused of withholding vital information from Stevens' lawyers. The judge in the case appointed a special prosecutor to investigate whether Marsh and the other lawyers broke the law, and the Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility also looked into it. NPR says the special prosecutor's report is due out in a few weeks and that a lawyer for Marsh says he thought his client would not be charged. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, educating Alaskans about the dangers of paralytic shellfish poisoning.
We see one of the highest reported incidences of PSP poisoning in the world. We have a very high death rate associated with PSP.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by North Rim Bank, helping you get from where you are to where you want to be. Achieve more. North Rim Bank for Business. Information at northrim.com. Member FDIC.
The commission put together by President Obama to look at the BP oil blowout in the Gulf of Mexico and how to prevent future spills talked over Arctic development today. At a Washington, D.C. hearing, Commissioner Fran Ulmer, who is also the chancellor of the University of Alaska Anchorage campus and served as the state's lieutenant governor, asked Alaska Senator Mark Begich about bills he's proposed to better protect against spills up north.
One could make the argument that you'd want that package in place before you actually made a deal on the Arctic. Because as you know right now, it's zero revenue sharing for the state.
Right.
And there are, yes, it's true that I think the industry has tried very hard to come up with response plans way in excess of what is either required or what is being done in other places. But there's still a lot of the flavor of we are at the edge of the frontier in some pretty powerful ways, given where we would be talking about doing business.
Begich says he expects to see energy legislation at the end of this year or early next year, which may contain some items he's pushing, like increasing the financial liability for oil corporations and requiring the companies to establish independent escrow accounts for spill victim compensation. But Begich says the Obama administration shouldn't wait for Congress to act before it allows development plans to start moving forward.
I think there's two pieces to the equation. You know, which one comes first? And because both take time, you know, a development that's just doing their geological survey doesn't come online next week or next year. There's a spread of time. And in a lot of ways, these should move, in my view, simultaneous.
The vice president of Shell Oil Alaska, Pete Slaby, says the delay is costing Shell $750,000 per day. He told the panel Shell is taking extra precautions so that when work can go forward, it's exceeding federal guidelines.
We're proposing to put a containment system in place as well. The containment system won't be as large as we've seen in the Gulf of Mexico, simply put, because our worst case discharge will not be as large as we can see in the Gulf of Mexico. So we've opted to go ahead and move and go forward on that one. Our system would be available, would be deployed in Alaska, and would be ready to go into service for our 2011 program.
But the mayor of the North Slope Borough, Edward Itta, testified by a video conference from his office in Alaska. He voiced concerns that the Arctic's extreme conditions will make any oil spill cleanup much more difficult than in the Gulf of Mexico.
This scale of disaster response could never happen in the Arctic. We lack the basic infrastructure to support it, much less connected by road to the rest of Alaska.
Salazar put a halt on Arctic drilling plans until a study is completed in March on Arctic oil issues. The National Commission on Offshore Drilling and the BP Deepwater Horizon spill plans to submit a report to President Obama on its findings later this year. Researchers, students, educators, and shellfish farmers met in Ketchikan last week to learn how to identify harmful algal blooms and analyze samples. Organizers are hoping expanded monitoring efforts will help keep the Alaska shellfish industry safe. KRBD's Maria Dudzak reports.
The Alaska Harmful Algal Bloom Monitoring Partnership, or AHAB, was co-founded by the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the University of Alaska Southeast. Partner agencies include the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the Kachemak Bay Research Reserve. Kate Sullivan is the Assistant Professor of Fisheries Technology at UAS Ketchikan and one of the organizers of the workshop.
What we're trying to do is really provide education and training to people that are impacted by harmful algal blooms so that they can then participate in the collection of environmental data, on the collection of information for larger research projects, and to really build the capacity of Alaskans to look at a very complex problem that has very significant human health impacts in Alaska.
Sullivan says the main focus of the workshop is teaching methods to sample for the toxin that causes paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP.
Paralytic shellfish poisoning and the associated toxicity in shellfish is a very significant issue to Alaska. We see one of the highest reported incidences of PSP poisoning in the world. We have a very high death rate associated with PSP, and we have people around Alaska that harvest shellfish, that make their livelihood related to shellfish, and we really need to do a better job of letting people know that this is a really serious and dangerous problem. There's no way to tell if you go to harvest a clam on a beach whether it is toxic or not, and so really one of the best tools we have is to provide education to people.
The microscopic organism that causes PSP is Alexandrium phytoplankton. Sullivan says testing is done during the cyst or seed-like stage of the Alexandrium's life cycle. Cysts, if present, live in marine sediments and bloom if temperature and sunlight conditions are ideal for their development. Vera Trainer, a researcher with NOAA's Northwest Fisheries Science Center in Seattle, specializes in studying harmful algal blooms. She says she is working to bring simple testing methods to areas that otherwise might not have access to a laboratory or testing facility.
It's taking those folks who are basically the eyes of the coast, and it is teaching them how to, number one, look for the cells in the water. So they collect cells and they look in the microscope and they learn to identify, aha, this is what an Alexandrium looks like. This is what these toxic cells look like. And then eventually what we also want to teach is some rapid tools for testing toxicity. So testing toxin either in seawater or in the shellfish themselves.
Trainer says one of the simple methods works much like a home pregnancy test kit.
You grind up your shellfish, you extract it in this case it's like an alcohol, and then you drip a small amount on this test strip and you get a line if the sample is positive.
She says some shellfish farmers in the Pacific Northwest are already regularly testing for PSP toxins using the kits. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska gets its fair share of disasters, such as severe storms, mudslides, volcanic eruptions, blizzards, and wildfires. Several villages have flooded in the past few years. In 2005, Koktovik lost its power source for days during high winds and temperatures of 20 below. And just this past week, Anchorage got a warning with a 4.9 magnitude earthquake and a series of aftershocks. There are ways to prepare, however, and state officials are trying to get the information out during Emergency Preparedness Month. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Public Information Officer Jeremy Zydek with the Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management says if local residents can take care of themselves for the first critical hours or days, responders can turn to other problems.
If that priority is satisfied. Emergency managers, first responders, they can turn their attention to the critically injured in restoring essential services as quickly as possible.
One of the ways to be prepared, says Zydek, is to have an emergency preparedness kit that includes food and 1 gallon of water per person per day for 7 days, among other things. The kit should also include a hand-cranked radio, flashlight, and extra batteries, first aid kit, face masks, sleeping bags, and safe indoor heat.
These can be items like a indoor safe propane heaters. They have a catalytic kind of ceramic converters on them, and they burn up the propane pretty fully so you don't have unsafe fumes coming into the home. They do require some ventilation.
The next step to being prepared is to have a family emergency plan, which Zydek says can help resolve a big source of anxiety.
The first thing that I'm going to think about after a major disaster is, where is my family and are they okay? If I have the number to the school, or my kids know that if something bad happens, for them to stay at school and I will come to them, and then all they have to think is, hey, I stay at the school, my parents will come and get me.
Don Brantley is Public Information Officer and Community Preparedness Coordinator for the Anchorage Office of Emergency Management. She says part of the problem is that people don't realize how they're going to respond during a true emergency.
Because when you have a disaster strike, you don't, your brain doesn't, you know, they don't really function as well. It's hard to think clearly. It's hard to know exactly what you need to do. You're worried about making mistakes. And when you don't have a plan that you've practiced several times and you don't have the supplies that you need, you lose precious time.
Zydek says the third part of preparedness is knowing what kinds of disasters or emergencies are likely to occur where you live. By having a kit, a plan, and information, Zydek says people have already made themselves that much more resilient or mentally and emotionally ready.
They themselves are personally prepared. Their family will be taken care of. They know where their family will be and how to get in touch with them, and they can really restore the family unit in short order and have the essential items that they're going to need to survive those few days where services are being restored.
Brantley says the municipality of Anchorage helps people prepare in other ways. Those include a registry for people with disabilities or medical needs, so responders know about their needs right away, information on how to put together a neighborhood watch group, and tips on how to take care of pets during an emergency. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Juneau's homegrown brewery has lost an appeal in a multi-million dollar case over distribution rights in Washington state, but company owners say it's not going to affect their bottom line. KTOO's Matt Miller has more on the opinion issued last week.
The Washington State Court of Appeals handed down the nearly $6.3 million judgment against Alaskan Brewing Company of Juneau.
So it's water under the bridge. No more appeals, no nothing else. It is what it is.
That's Alaskan Brewing President Jeff Larson. The figure is essentially the fair market value for exclusive distribution rights for Alaskan beer in 7 Washington state counties, largely in the Puget Sound area. The dispute arose after the rights, as held by Kent, Washington-based Alaska Distributors Company, were put up for sale 2 years ago. The opinion issued by the appeals court says Alaskan Brewing only gave 4 days' notice of its intent to terminate their contract with Alaska Distributors rather than 90 days. Larson says the opinion doesn't tell the whole story.
It was our contract having to do with our brand with Alaska Distributors. Alaska Distributors was going out of business, and so the brand was being purchased by another wholesaler, and that wholesaler is the one who paid for the fair market value. And the dispute was between the buying and selling wholesalers over our brand. And that's why our name is in this court action.
An arbitrator ruled that Alaska Distributors was owed $5.5 million for the rights' fair market value. That's instead of the $1.4 million in liquidated damages that court documents say Alaskan Brewing had advocated for.
And so the wholesaler that purchased our brand had a concern about the fair market valuation. So the whole arbitration was between the two wholesalers.
A trial court declined to overrule the arbitrator's decision and up the award another $800,000 for interest and attorney's fees, but Larson says the new wholesaler, Renton-based K&L Distributors, already paid for the rights.
And he actually purchased it a year ago.
The appeals court decision doesn't tread any new ground, but Seattle area attorney Doug Reeser, who also writes for brewerylaw.com, says the decision highlights the enormous deference given to a single arbitrator.
It shut the door on challenging arbitration rulings. It really kind of showed that there are extremely, extremely limited circumstances in which you can challenge an arbitration award in the state of Washington. And that's probably the ruling nationwide across most states.
Reeser also notes what he calls statutory protections afforded to distributors when contracts are terminated by small brewers.
2009, they changed it to 200,000 barrels, which would have got Alaskan out of this.
Calls placed to the last known business number for Alaska Distributors or its president, Stephen Loeb, were not returned. The company announced plans to lay off 600 people and sell assets to other distributors at the same time as it was selling Alaskan Brewing's distribution rights.
And we're selling beer in Seattle and enjoy making it and trying to provide the best service we can to our retail customers, and hopefully the consumer gets the service that they want, a nice cold glass of beer after work.
Alaskan Brewing Company is privately owned, and Larson declined to reveal his company's financial details, but he does say that production is about 125,000 barrels a year, and they employ 80 people, mostly in the Juneau area. According to the latest rankings by the Brewers Association, Alaskan Brewing is 11th among craft brewers and 18th overall among all breweries in the country. Those rankings are based on sales volume. A craft brewery is defined as an independent and traditional operation with less than 2 million barrels of annual production. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Austin Jenkins in Washington State, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, and Matt Miller in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.